In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up today, it's PMQs Unpacked. Patrick McGuire, Times columnist, and Caroline Weeder, the Sunday Times political editor, join me to pause the action from the House of Commons to analyse the key exchanges between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak in real time. Lara Spirit rounds up the best of the rest. And the columnists today, Alice Thompson and Hadley Freeman, on what Kemi Badenoch and Taylor Swift have got in common. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me live for Politics at the Boring Bits on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. So, it was off to the Parliamentary Book Awards last night, hosted and run by the Booksellers Association and the Publishers Association. I was hosting it again for the fourth year, I think. We did it the first time during COVID, did it on the radio. Now doing it in person. It's a lovely evening, mixing independent bookshop owners, who are the loveliest people in the world, publishers of political books, who are the most optimistic people in the world, and MPs who can read. Or at least look at the nice pictures. Speaking of which, nice pictures in my book, Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors, which was nominated. We'll come to that in a minute. Previous winners of these prizes include Pharrella Benjamin, Penny Mordaunt and Andrew Mitchell. So if this year's winners play their cards right, this time next year they could be a children's TV presenter, carrying a sword or making David Cameron's tea. So basically what happens, the publishers enter them in for the awards. They're then shortlisted by the independent bookshops and then it's voted on by MPs and peers. So I wasn't all that hopeful. Apparently, apart from mine, there were other books published in the last 12 months. Although we are still waiting for Boris Johnson's biography of Shakespeare. Still not got that. Tim Shipman's third book on Brexit. Longer gestation period than an elephant, that book. But apparently it is coming. And, of course, Liz Truss's much-anticipated book, The Only Conservative in the Room. Which seems like a pretty brutal review for Turnout at a launch of PopCon yesterday. There was a great shortlist last night celebrating memoirs, autobiography, history and fiction. Sadly, Nadine Dorris missed out on being shortlisted, although mainly because they still don't know if the plot is something that she's lost or a highly accurate piece of investigative journalism. We just don't know. Philippa Gregory was shortlisted for her great book, Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History. I mean, it's a nice idea, that, but I think it's a shame to ignore the good work that men have done over the years, but they're just too shy to blow their own trumpets about it. Speaking of which, Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart were both shortlisted, both absent, though. I imagine that's probably the fault of Boris Johnson and Brexit. No, seriously, though, apparently they were actually very busy counting all that lovely podcast money. So, let's get on to the proper business then, because I know these might be books that you want to read, you know, if you're interested in political books. In for best biography, memoir or autobiography by a parliamentarian were Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad by our very own Daniel Finkstein, One Boy, Two Bills and a Fight by Wes Streeting, and A Purposeful Life by Dawn Butler. And that was won by Danny Finkelstein. So well done to Danny. It's a terrific book. If you haven't read it yet, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad is an extraordinary read, albeit quite a hard read at times, but it's an incredible book. So well deserved by Danny. In the category of best fiction or non-fiction by a parliamentarian, shortlisted were Politics on the Edge by Rory Stewart, Code of Conduct by Chris Bryant, and The Winding Stair by Jesse Norman. And that one was won by Jesse Norman, his novel The Winding Stair. He wasn't there, apparently. But I mean, I know he wasn't there. He sent his apologies. But then, in the best political book by a non-parliamentarian, five in this one, But What Can I Do by Alistair Campbell, Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History by Philippa Gregory, An Uneasy Inheritance by Polly Toynbee, Bust by Robert Peston and Kishan Kuria, and, I don't know if I mentioned this before, Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors, 50 Places That Changed British Politics by Matt Chorley. So it fell to, I wasn't allowed to announce the winner of my own category, apparently, because that would have been awkward. So it fell to Dame Margaret Hodge to announce the winner.
And the winner is Matt Chorley.
It's absolutely extraordinary that I've won an election, because I'm the only person on how to win an election who's never won an election, but more importantly, I've won an election voted for by MPs and peers, which suggests I haven't upset enough of them, or at least I'm more popular than Alistair Campbell. Right, let's dive in then to the drinks reception here in the Houses of Parliament. Let's go and speak to Wes Streeting, who, well, he didn't win.
You know, Matt Chorley, the best man won in my category, which was Danny Finkelstein's brilliant book, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, which, as well as being an incredible, moving, inspiring book, also meant as a losing author I couldn't heckle. Because you can't heckle a book called Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad. But, you know, at least in my category, the best book won. Who won in your category, Matt?
Very rude. Chess Phillips, why are you laughing so hard at that?
I was delighted to see you win, thank Matt, you. Because I felt like you didn't expect it.
I actually did genuinely vote for you. Yeah. Mainly out of loyalty.
I'm not saying that now.
I did vote for you.
If I found out you voted for Alistair Campbell, we'd never speak again.
Never.
Don't tell him, I actually did vote for your book.
I will tell him.
And I prefer your podcast as well.
Well, clip that up. Are you going to write another one?
No, not at this stage in my career. Maybe the sort of the later, you know, at the end of my life.
The Twilight years.
Wait, straight in the Downing Street years.
Oh yes.
No, I don't think so. I think more like how the NHS saved my life and how the NHS nearly broke my life would probably be. If I'm the long-suffering health secretary I aspire to be, that's...
Sorry, Wes, Daniel Finkelstein's here now, and he's... sorry, it's really just for the winners, this. Danny, how pleased are you to win, having been voted for by parliamentarians?
The problem, Wes, is being folded into Matt's smugness. It's, like, really embarrassing. So I just want all listeners to know that I don't share this, you know, what will definitely one day become schadenfreude. The truth is, I was really thrilled to be nominated with Wes's book because I thought it was brilliant. So to hear Wes say those nice things about the book is like a prize in itself, really. It's really
nice. This is all getting a bit insufferable.
I know, it's a loving.
Well done, everyone.
I'd just like to point out to listeners as well, this was a vote by parliamentarians, and only one of us, you know, me and Danny, has actually run an election campaign operation. So I think that, you know, it was clearly a great GOTV operation. Yeah.
I'm quite glad the result in this was different to any of the election campaigns I ran.
This is a great advert for your How to Win an Election.
Yeah. He's finally won one. Jess, Wes, Danny, lovely to see you. And there we are. That was fun. Right, better get on with it then. That's enough backslapping. The Columnists. And it's a Wednesday, so we have got Alice Thompson. Alice
Good morning,
is here.
Matt.
But Robert Crampton is still on his never-ending holiday.
It's getting browner and browner, I think, isn't he?
He would be unrecognisable. Won't need any of his fake tans, will he?
Well, he might come back in any way. He might wear his budgie smugglers, might he?
Well, let's take that thought out of our minds. Instead, we are joined by the brilliant Sunday Times columnist, Hadley Freeman. Hadley, how are you?
Hi, Matt. Congrats on your win. Very exciting.
Thank you. I don't want to go on about it. The most astonishing thing is it's only voted for by MPs and peers, which well, suggests I've not upset enough of them.
No, I think it's very illustrious to have that voting.
Do you? Mm. Yeah, yeah. What an electorate to have won over.
And I'm very worried that Nadine Dorris didn't get one for hers.
Well, I think, yeah, maybe they didn't know what category to put it in. Fiction or non-fiction or fantasy or...
I think fantasy is quite a good
romance.
One. Yeah.
Yeah.
Futuristic.
Children's literature. Anyway, enough of me, Hadley. Let's talk about you. Please, right, you wrote a column at the weekend linking these two.
Hello, my name is Kemi Badenoch and I am the Member of Parliament for Saffron Walden.
I'm Taylor. I was born in 1989.
That is excellent. Top marks. Who did that? Was that producer Ollie? Right? Very good. Well done, Ollie. So, take us through this then. What have Kemi and Taylor got in common, Hadley?
Well, I feel like, firstly, this is a classic example of a headline slightly determining people's interpretation of the column, because the Kemi reference really was just one paragraph. It is mainly about Taylor Swift. But I do stand by this point, which is I think people expect a woman's personal background, her identity, as we now say, to be more influential on what she's like as an adult, on her beliefs and where she goes in life than they do with men. Men can kind of determine themselves. So with Taylor Swift, my point was the reason that she's the subject of so many MAGA conspiracies now, and all these conservative men in America are going on TV shows and talking about how old she is and what a slut she is because she comes from this country and Western background and started off singing these very innocent songs about love. And then she really moved away from that quite quickly. As soon as she became successful, she's now much more pop-based, a little bit of folk music sometimes. She's had various boyfriends. And now she's going out with a Midwest football player, Travis Kelce, which has kind of confused them even more. So it's that kind of thing of this, it's almost like they see her as their teenage daughter who has betrayed her roots. And the thing with Kemi Badenoch that I think is quite interesting is I have seen a lot of, well, she seems to drive liberal men particularly crazy, way more than Sajid Javid ever did, way more even than Rishi Sunak does, about her anti-immigration policies, about her pro-Brexit policies. And one thing that's often brought up is that she is the daughter of immigrants herself. Never mind that second-generation immigrants often have very conflicting and different views on immigration than perhaps liberals who've lived in this country for four generations assume. It's the fact that she is a Black woman who is anti-immigration and quite hard-line about certain things that I think some liberals find very confusing. So the point is about how a woman's identity affects how people interpret her beliefs.
It was, go on, Alison. I thought it was really interesting, this. And it was one of those things I hadn't really thought about, the grief that not just Kemi, but Swetha Braverman and Priti Patel have about their views on immigration and their heritage in a way that it's not thrown around it. I don't know, Rishi Sunak or James Cleverly or
I think women get so much more kickback, don't they? So that is the problem in politics. And Kemi Badenoch is a very particular example of someone who's incredibly coherent, and she's a strong personality and she knows where she's going. And that does infuriate probably mostly liberals. But it's also the idea that all women have to be utterly brilliant to get to the top, whereas men can be totally mediocre. So that we have this sort of sense that they've all got to outshine everyone else if they're a woman. You can't have anyone in the cabinet who's not, you know, a star. And that I think we do have much higher expectations, whereas I think what's good now is we've got enough women coming through that some of them I think are quite mediocre. I would say Suella Braverman's very mediocre, to be honest. But I like that. I mean, there's so many mediocre men out there that I think it's balancing it up a bit. And I think with Taylor Swift is the opposite. I think she really is a phenomenon. She's extraordinary. And I would like her to have the Democratic nomination. I would like her to go head-to-head, because I think the only person who can really take on someone like Donald Trump would be Taylor Swift, wouldn't it?
I mean, that would be amazing.
It would be phenomenal and fantastic. And she has that base, as you know, as Hadley says, she kind of spans the whole of America. She would be great. And I think to have Travis as the first man would be wonderful. I would love it. It would be great. I might even move to America if that happened.
Well, the big hope is, because it's the Super Bowl this Sunday and Travis is playing in it, and the big rumor is, first of all, that Taylor's going to fly back from her tour in Japan to be there. But then also, A, she's going to perform in the Super Bowl, which I think might be a little bit optimistic. But B, that he will propose to her at the Super Bowl, at which point I think America will actually explode.
Mm. Well, what would be good if she performed and then he proposed and then she publicly backed Biden?
She's got to go for it herself, I think, now. I don't think she can back Biden.
Or announce her own run.
Yeah. Well, Biden, I think, is just so old. The thing is, she's got youth on her side, hasn't she? I mean, I think we now know with Biden, now that he's mixing up his prime ministers and his presidents and his countries quite so much, I think you do need to move on. And I think she is an extraordinary star. I think she's, you know, the way that she's taken on the record companies, the way that she takes on the producers, everything that Taylor Swift done, it's sort of extraordinary. You can say it's very easy if you're a famous singer, but a lot of those women out there have not. You know, Britney Spears, you look at them, they've been completely crushed by the system.
And actually, the point that you make, Hadley, in your piece is that the way she has moved from, you know, she didn't really used to talk very much about politics, coming from this sort of southern country base. The bit that I hadn't totally clocked before, but your point that you make is that the Dixie Chicks got into so much trouble for being critical of George W. Bush, almost to the point of being cancelled. I hadn't really caught that Willie Nelson, similar country singer, had done basically exactly the same thing and hadn't made, you know, had sailed through that largely unscathed.
Yeah, and no one cares. And he was a big public supporter for Beto O'Rourke, for example, who's also from Texas, and was very critical of Bush for the anti-gay policies. And no one cared at all. It is really striking, that difference.
Yeah, it's a great piece. I thought the headline it drew me. Well, I would have obviously read it anyway, Hadley, with a terrible headline on it, which we sometimes all get on our columns. Let's talk about Joe Biden, as Alice was just saying, who has gotten a muddle again. So this time, this was him talking about Emmanuel Macron, but got him confused with François Mitterrand, who was the French president who died in 1996. Let's take a listen.
When I sat down and I said, America's back, and Mitterrand from France looked at me and said, said, you know, how long are you back for?
He also got France and Germany muddled up there. And then he also, on a separate occasion, appeared to forget the name Hamas.
There is some movement, and maybe choose my words. There's some movement. There's been a response from the opposition, but I'm sorry, from Hamas.
It is painful, isn't it?
It is quite. I mean, and then there was remember the thing when he kept shouting, is so-and-so here? Is she here? Is she here? And she died. The woman, who was the person? I can't remember who it was.
And then he stumbled, didn't he? The problem is he just looks like not even a sort of grandparent almost. We're getting on to great-grandparent status, aren't we? I mean, that sense that he can't remember anything, that he's, you know, he's muddled. I mean, the Germany-France is almost as bad as the Mitterrand-Macron, isn't it? That you know, you can't even get your country right.
I mean, I think the thing I'd say about Biden is, I don't think he wants to run for president. He didn't really want to run for president last time. He did it because he was trying to stop Trump. And the other point is that Trump is at least as rambly and incoherent as Biden at this point. And I feel for Biden. I mean, he is kind of being pushed as the only Democrat who can stop Trump. And it's a ridiculous situation how America's gotten itself into this mess, that these two very old men are the only candidates for president. And we can blame Obama for this, for having appointed a quite old man at the time as his vice president. But, you know, by the second term of the Obama presidency, everyone really thought it was going to be Hillary for the next term. So it wasn't such an issue. But I feel like once we get through this election, 2028 is going to be an entirely new open field. And hopefully we will have some 40 and 50 somethings running as we used to do. I mean, the amazing thing is Bill Clinton was president 30 years ago, and he is still younger than Trump and Biden are now.
That is amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's like, I mean, now we do have Rishi Sunak back again, but I mean, we've had some quite elderly ones and then some very young ones. You can never really tell, can you? I mean, do you remember William Hague, we thought, was like, you know, still in shorts, wasn't he?
But actually, I mean, how old's John Major? Is he younger than... he's 80.
He's 80, yeah.
So he's basically... I mean, I suppose it's the same as the Bill Clinton thing. Basically, I mean, he's a bit older, but basically
well, John
the same
Major,
age.
David Cameron's come back. I mean, we could have lots of them coming back, couldn't we, if you can carry on till you're 80.
I mean, Biden has been around forever. And it's taken him this long to get to the White House, poor man. But I mean, I feel for him. I really feel for Jill, his wife. I mean, neither of them, both of them know that this is a bad idea. It's clearly a disaster. And Trump, as I said, is just as bad, sort of mentally and worse morally. But there's no one else who can run in their stead. Yeah. I mean, so what can you do?
Now, I know you talked about the power of Taylor Swift in backing Joe Biden, Hadley. What do you think about, I think it's basically the equivalent here, Holly Valance backing Jacob Rees-Mogg? I don't know if you're across this.
I did see that at the pop conference, yes.
Do you think, is that the British equivalent?
Well, as a long-term Home and Away fan, I'm very excited about the return of Holly Valance to the political stage. I could not endorse this more.
Well, I'll tell you what, actually, I was slightly stunned. So Holly Valance was at the PopCon event yesterday. And she spoke to, because her husband, Nick Candy, has been a donor to the Tories in the past, but hasn't recently. And she spoke to GB News and backed Jacob Rees-Mogg, saying the speakers were fantastic. I thought Liz was really interesting to listen to. Jacob for Prime Minister, she said. Now, GB News described her as being an actress and a model, completely eliminating her extraordinary pop back catalogue, including Kiss Kiss.
Absolutely. One of the all-time classics, I would say.
I can't remember any of the others. I imagine we've not got any Holly Valance in the system, so we can't play any.
I want Adele to come up, actually. I think Taylor Swift versus Adele, that's the one. You know, that's the only person in this country who would be extraordinary if she suddenly backed someone, wouldn't it? I mean, she is probably our biggest name to do that.
Do you think we got all that out of our system, though, during Brexit? That all of the celebrities backed Remain?
We don't really like celebrities doing it, yeah. And the Pop-Tarts, yeah. I think, I mean, you know, if we had them being sort of pushed by...
Pop-Tarts?
Well, you know, popcorn. I think they're Pop-Tarts, aren't they, really,
are they?
Now? Yeah. What, don't you think?
They were more popular in the 90s.
Yeah, they're kind of, you know, that's sort of, they're better as an idea than anything else, aren't they? You put them in the toaster and they're all a bit flaccid and, you know, I think Pop-Tarts is what we need to start
calling
them.
I feel like we're workshopping my column live on air from Holly Valance and Pop-Tarts.
Pop-Tarts.
There's something there.
Did you ever like Pop-Tarts?
No, I don't think we were allowed them. I might have had them once and I think I was very excited about them. And then I had one and they were...
A disappointment.
Really disappointing.
They were.
Like a Liz Truss speech. Mm. Yeah.
I think you've got a column there.
Yeah, get that written. David is sort of live fact-checking us as we go. I think this is aimed at you, Hadley. Holly Valance never appeared in Home and Away. She was in Neighbours.
Oh, God, sorry.
There we are.
That's the American to make that mistake, sorry.
He goes on to say, Trump, Bush and Clinton were all born within a few months of each other. Clinton was youngish when he became president. Bush was a fairly unremarkable age. Trump was old. Biden is older. So thank you for that, David. Covering. That might be the most Times radio message of the day. but covering both Holly Valance's acting career and the ages of the last four US presidents. Alice, let's turn our attention to your column now. You've written today about... this idea of banning smartphones for under 16s. Good idea.
I let my children all have smartphones when they got to about 11 and they are now, you know, late teenage. So they were sort of okay. They got the beginning of it. But I do now look at it and think that was a mistake and that they would be like, it's like handing them out alcohol. This idea that we give them phones and that they get used to them and that they need to understand about technology, which is what I thought at the beginning, I think is wrong, actually. I think they're so addictive. And I think particularly, say, TikTok with young boys, when the algorithms just keep pushing you further and further towards misogynist content. I think if I was a young parent now, I would try and ban them. And I think it's very hard as a parent individually. So I think schools should actually step forward, and I think that, you know, that at the moment they're encouraged to, but they don't have to, and I think that we shouldn't be selling smartphones to children under 16.
Well, in fact, we heard at the weekend, because there was another announcement on banning mobile phones in schools at the Tory conference last year, and Education Secretary Gillian Keegan said they were just still getting around to drawing up the guidance, and then they'll consult on it. So that, even that feels like it's still some way off. Let's bring in the Labour MP, Charlotte Nicholls, Labour MP for Warrington North. Because Charlotte, you also about this. Obviously, this idea of limiting access to social media was put forward by the mother of Brianna Jai at the weekend. How would you this work in practice, Charlotte?
So I think there's a few different ways of looking at it. There are various technologies that already exist. So it might be the case that it's about meaning that young people have to have a sort of basic phone, essentially the sorts of things that you and I probably grew up with. But you can also look at things like operating systems that would limit certain types of content and that would bring the kind of technology that's in school computers that flags keyword searches and things like that, that would be something that would be available on parents' phones, monitoring what their children are up to on their own devices.
Hadley, what do you think about this?
I think it's a brilliant idea. My children are still young. They're 8 and 4, but I've got friends with teenagers, and all of them have gone through a thing of their children being bullied at school on social media, you know, through Instagram direct messages and WhatsApp groups and all that. I fully back it. We just need to see how insane smartphones drive all of us as grown-ups. I'm constantly picking up my phone. I mean, the idea of my children having it just seems crazy. I've thought for a while that the best thing to do would be for everybody to have a dumb phone until they're at least 18, you know, the old Nokia with no internet and apps on it. But the problem is that the world is now shaped around smartphones. Like, you can't park without a smartphone. Not, I presume, that many
teenagers are.
No, but also you can't go to school. My daughter's school, we talked about this the other day, her whole life, her school life, her planner, her homework, her attendance, achievement points, you know, is all done through an app on a phone.
So that is the problem. So also, they quite often they end up doing their homework on the phones. They're told to do research. And all the research shows that actually, if you're on your phone doing your homework, you spend 37% of your time on social media looking up messages. And I think that's the problem. You get 257 alerts on average a day if you're a teenager. I mean, that's why I'm not sure I think that schools should be putting everything onto the phone. That I think actually they should be talking and discussing with them. They should be writing. We know that handwriting is really important still. They should put everything in old-fashioned diaries, probably.
And then, Charlotte, you've got a debate in Parliament today on mindfulness in schools. What do you want to see happen there?
So since Esther's daughter Brianna's murder, she's fundraised over £50,000 working with the Warrington Guardian to bring the Mindfulness into Schools project into schools in Warrington. And our ask today from the government is that this is something that they make national policy.
And explain to people who don't know, what would lessons in mindfulness in schools look like? What does that actually involve?
So this is something that is already policy in Wales. The government there introduced mindfulness into the curriculum as part of the curriculum in wellbeing there in 2022. And in the schools in Warrington, we're already seeing some real benefits. Now, it doesn't need to be discrete lessons necessarily, although at some of the schools, for example, it will be 5 or 10 minutes in the morning to get children ready and focused for their learning that day. But it's about embedding it into the wider culture of the school, so helping young people to understand their feelings before acting on them and making sure that we're building that mental resilience for young people at a time of a mental health crisis that the NHS is ill-equipped to deal with.
So what about this, Alice? Do you think this is a good idea?
Well, my only problem with mindfulness, I think, is that it is quite difficult to settle the class and get them to do something like that. But I do like it. I also like the idea of doing more exercise in schools, though, too. I think that actually getting children running around and doing stuff And I think that anything that helps with mental health with young children, because it's so difficult to access any specialist care, is good in schools. So, yeah, I do agree. I just think we have to be careful how you do the mindfulness, and it doesn't just become 10 minutes of children sort of twitching away and kind of throwing things at each other, which it can be. I know with my children, whenever I tried mindfulness, that they tended to get more restless rather than more relaxed.
I tried it. I don't know if you've ever done this, Hadley. I tried one of the mindfulness apps, and it drove me mad.
Yeah, I have to say I'm not great at it. But, you know, my children, so I've got 8-year-old twins and the little 4-year-old, they like doing kids yoga, which I kind of think combines what Alice was saying, which is exercise, as well as the idea of relaxing. The problem with mindfulness is it's a very vague term. I personally think that in terms of children's mental health, one of the best things would be getting rid of the smartphones and getting rid of them being on the internet all day long.
Well, that was a problem. It turned out that I was trying to do mindfulness using an app on my phone.
Yes, quite.
It all joins up in the end. Hadley, really good to speak to you. Hadley Freeman there, Alice Thompson, and thank you, Labour MP Charlotte Nicholls as well. Has got that debate in Parliament later on today. Hadley Freeman from the Sunday Times, Alice Thompson from the Times, and of course you can read them every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next is PMQ's Unpacked.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and
Patrick Maguire and Caroline Wheeler. Hello to you both.
Good afternoon.
Patrick, you're a semi-regular at this.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. I don't know, your name's dropped off the jingle. There is a jingle with your name.
There is a jingle with my name on it, yeah.
That's happened there. Oh, yeah. And Caroline Wheeler, your debut on PMQ's
Indeed.
Unpacked.
Yeah.
Where would you normally be at this time on a Wednesday? Would you normally be in the press gallery?
No, not normally, actually. I religiously used to go to Prime Minister's Questions, but having done it for pretty much 20 years,
yeah.
It kind of has lost its allure a little bit because it very rarely continues news into the Sunday. So
try and pick your up. It's going to be gripping. It's gripping radio. Carol and I first worked together in the regional lobby when we did have to go and watch
every week. Yeah.
Now look at us.
Yeah, exactly. Preferring to have lunch, but being here is a complete and utter honour and huge privilege.
What do you think Keir Starmer will go on today?
I think he'll talk about the bet. I mean, that seems to have really, really kind of got people talking about kind of how, you know, out of touch the Prime Minister is, which is a subject that he's gone on about numerous times at PMQs before. It seems to work well for him, talking about him being the kind of billionaire Prime Minister. So I think at some point we'll see a reference to that.
And the Labour Party have been pumping out ads, Patrick, of Rishi Sunak taking Piers Morgan's £1,000 bet.
Yeah, they have. And that is the worst part. It's almost the worst possible person for Rishi Sunak to have taken a bet with, right? Everybody knows who Piers Morgan is. And it reinforces one of the things both parties are in their focus groups all the time, which is that the Prime Minister is considered to be rich and out of touch.
And anyone, in fact, because it obviously happened, we did our latest focus group on Friday night, so we didn't catch it, but I imagine if we did it again,
they would all notice.
They'll all be saying, I don't have £1,000 to go around doing daft bets with Piers Morgan.
Exactly. And also, as you said in the latest House of an Election podcast, ding, 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 you control the bell, not me. It's one of those things that people will notice. It's a political story that has cut through precisely because that image of him shaking hands with Piers Morgan is incredibly striking.
And of course, it's about Rwanda.
Yeah, indeed.
Which, you know, and the fact
it's
that
it's a perfect storm.
It's a perfect storm of all the things. Well, here we go then. We can go live to the House of Commons. I suspect we'll also, I imagine everyone who speaks will have to say nice things about the King as well. That just goes without saying. Everyone will say exactly the same things. But we'll still have to sit through that. Let's go live to the House of Commons then. Question number one from Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I join with the Prime Minister in sending His Majesty the King our very best wishes for his treatment. Across this House, we all look forward to seeing him back to full health as quickly as possible. Mr. Speaker, this week, the unwavering bravery of Brianna Jay's mother, Esther, has touched us all. As a father, I can't even imagine the pain that she's going through, and I'm glad that she's with us in the gallery here today. Mr. Speaker, a year ago, the Prime Minister promised to bring NHS waiting lists down. Isn't he glad he didn't bet a grand on it?
Good, well done, Caroline.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker.
Esther.
Mr. Speaker, at least I stand by my commitments. He's so indecisive, the only bet he'd make is an each-way bet.
Oh, dear.
Apparently, the Prime Minister's not a gambling man yet. He's incredibly au fait with the specifics of what you can get in the bookies. And, of course, he told Test Match Special last year he loves gambling.
Yeah. Well, you were right. The NHS waiting list and the bet were going to come up. Whatever workshopping they've done in Number 10... about him and an each-way bet. Does that work, Caroline?
I'm not sure it does. I mean, he's obviously... The thing he said there about, you know, at least I stand by my commitment is obviously a dig about the fact that the Labour Party has spent the last 6 months rowing back from their decision to spend £28 billion on sort of green energy investment. So that's kind of a bit of a jibe there, but I'm not sure it works. I'm not sure that it particularly cuts through. I think the overriding thing people are going to come away from is that we've got a Prime Minister that's bet another wealthy individual a lot of money.
And also, there's no point in saying I stick to my pledges if you don't deliver on any of them.
And Rwanda being one of them.
Rwanda's one, yeah. NHS waiting list is another one, growing the economy is another one, exactly. Bringing down debt is another one. It's so, well, I haven't dropped my promises, I just haven't met them.
Yeah, it's striking that he could have used that opportunity to much more aggressively restate his commitment to planes taking off within the year, which he didn't really do.
There's also a weird thing, and I imagine we might hear something about this, the Treasury... or have released something called opposition policy costings. The Tory party are tweeting about it. Breaking officials reveal that a key plank of Labour's policy costs double what they claim. Seems slightly weird.
Interesting use of civil service resources,
yeah.
Labour will inevitably say.
This page shows the government's costing of opposition policies. Looking at the National Warm Homes Plan. So there we are.
They've got a lot more time on their hands than most of us, I think, clearly.
Well, the government isn't doing anything, so they might as well get on with it.
Yeah.
Get ahead for the autumn. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons then. Now we've got the lame betting jokes out of the way. Where does it go next? We are live on the YouTube channel. Sorry, I've been told off because we haven't said hello to the people who are on the YouTube channel. Candy is in upstate New York. Stephen is in Sleaford. Lou is in Pennsylvania. Tom is checking in from the soggy Solent. Ross is in Guildford. Martin's in Northolt. Nick says, has Patrick brushed his hair? No. What has Patrick brushed his hair with, we are wondering.
I don't know. Well, nothing.
Nothing, apparently. Greetings from Marlborough.
I just passed it when I got out of the shower. Oh, God, it does look awful.
Dave is in Glasgow. Well, you're on the radio. Heather says, am I the only person who doesn't have a copy of Matt's book? I hope not, Heather. Well, as you're online, open another window while you're watching along on the YouTube channel. You can order one as we go to question number two from Keir Starmer.
Well, Mr. Speaker, he says he stands by his commitments. He once insisted that if he missed his promises, these are the words he used, I'm the Prime Minister, and then he said, it's on me personally. Today we learned from his own officials that he's the blocker to any deal to end the doctor strikes. Yep. And he's always, every time he's asked, he blames everyone else. So what exactly did he mean when he said, it's on him personally, if he doesn't meet his promise?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we are bringing the waiting list down for the longest waiters. We're making progress. But it's a bit rich, Mr. Speaker, to hear about promises from someone who's broken every single promise he was elected on. I mean, I think I counted almost 30 in the last year. Pensions, planning, peerages, public sector pay, tuition fees, childcare, second referendums, defining a woman. Although in fairness, that was only 99% of a U-turn. The list goes on, but the theme is the same, Mr. Speaker. It's empty words, broken promises, and absolutely no plan. Yeah!
I might not have met my promises, but you've broken yours.
Before you've had the opportunity to keep them. I mean, it's clear what Keir Starmer's trying to do now. I think he's going to, you know, you get six questions. I think he's going to ask about all five of the pledges the Prime Minister made last year and then use the six to...
wrap it all up and tell a few
classic Keir Starmer gags. That list of things from Rishi Sunak there were, yes, the $28 billion, etc., other policies there that Labour have U-turned on and watered down pledges on, but some of them just seem to be probably made up.
Well, he does have a bit of form for that, doesn't he? I mean, you know, ditching of certain meat taxes and things like that have happened in the past.
I thought he was going to actually do quite a good joke of just doing, and that's just the peas, or that's just taking the peas or something. Because they've all began with pensions and blah, blah, blah. And then you just sort of drifted off into other things. Patrick, or either of you, can you explain the 99% joke?
It was an interview with me, yes.
And it was when he was sort of softening his position about, you know, whether or not you could be a woman and have a penis. And he basically told me that 99% of women didn't have a penis and that somehow made it all right, which I think actually ended up getting him into more trouble than his previous position had been. And he's obviously subsequently U-turned on that position as well. So, you know, on that one, yes, I think Rishi's got a point, to be honest.
Well, he could have put penis in the list of P's.
P's, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, you missed a trick there.
Yeah, pensions, penises. We've got them all covered here on Times Radio. Let's go back to House of Commons. Question number three from Keir Starmer.
Of all the work, of all the weeks to say that, when Brianna's mother is in this chamber, shame, parading as a man of integrity when he's got absolutely no responsibility. Absolute. Of all...
But either side. I think the member's getting carried away. Can I just say that our constituents wants to hear the questions and they certainly want to hear the answers. They don't want to hear organised barracking. So please, I want no more. Keir Starmer.
I think the role of the Prime Minister is to ensure that every single citizen in this country feels safe and respected. It's a shame the Prime Minister doesn't share that. I welcome the fact that he's finally admitted that he's failed on waiting lists in the NHS. I also welcome that he's finally acknowledged the crisis in NHS dentistry. He's calling it a recovery plan after 14 years of Tory government. What exactly does he think the NHS dentistry is recovering from?
Prime Minister.
As ever, Mr. Speaker, he seems to convene...
Certainly not have enough of the front bench either. Please, I want to hear it.
That's Lindsay Hall telling us the election
fever.
Side.
I'm hoping is not coming tomorrow, so let's not behave as though it is, Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as ever, he conveniently forgets the impact of a pandemic on NHS dentistry, and it was specifically because of the close proximity nature of dental provision that it was unable to operate as normal throughout the pandemic. That was the recommendation of the medical and clinical experts, Mr. Speaker, which is why, inevitably, there is a backlog in dental care and the impact that it has. But that's why, as my honourable friend, the Health Secretary, will outline later today for the House, we're putting more funding in to provide more NHS provision across the country, on top of plans that will see the number of dental training places increase by 40%, Mr. Speaker. But I would actually just point out, our plans mean that there will be 2.5 million more NHS appointments, which is in fact three times more than the Labour Party are proposing.
Right, so Keir Starmer clearly very cross about Rishi Sunak making the joke about what a woman is, given that Brianna Jai's family are in the gallery, in the press gallery, in the public gallery in the Commons, which Keir Starmer was talking about. Will that become a problem, do you think, Caroline?
It looked to me, and it's difficult not being there because you can't quite read the room, it looked to me a little bit confected because I don't think that, you know, drawing that kind of attention to that particular case is actually a great thing for Labour to have done either.
Well, yeah, they could be accused of playing politics with that. I guess it depends if Esther Guy comes out afterwards and said, you know, tax the Prime Minister for that. Clearly, it's a different sort of thing, but it will probably depend on her reaction and if she says anything about what the Prime Minister says. But it's very bold of Keir Starmer. You know, the Keir Starmer 2 or 3 years ago probably wouldn't have
called it out
or thought on his feet or been, you know.
And then use it to attack his integrity.
Well, completely, completely.
I suppose that actually it depends, you know, in what. I don't actually know in what basis she. Esther is in the gallery. Is she there as a guest of Keir Starmer? Is she? I don't know if she's aligned herself.
It sounded like it, didn't it? Because he drew attention to it rather than the Prime
which
Minister.
Which I'm not actually supposed to do, is draw attention to people who are in the gallery. That's the other thing, which is a sort of slightly separate point. But yes, it depends. Rishi Sunak just laid out his entirely pre-panned jokes and probably hadn't thought it through. But yeah, Keir Starmer clearly very riled by it. But let's see. So what we've done now, so we've done inflation, we've done NHS. Where do you think we're going now, Patrick?
It's a very good question.
thanks very much.
The economic growth, maybe?
Yeah, let's find out. Question number four, Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, there are some areas in the country where you literally can't have an NHS dentist. And he says that's down to COVID. People are literally pulling out their own teeth. Sorry.
Lindsay Hoyle. Can I just say, now I don't need any more off this front bench either. Do we understand each other? Carry on.
I love questions, Mr. Speaker.
People are literally pulling their teeth out using pliers. It's an experience that can be compared with extracting an answer from the Prime Minister at this dispatch box. The truth is, after 14 years of neglect, this recovery plan is just a desperate attempt to try to recover back to square one. Yeah. If he wanted to move forward, he should follow Labour, scrap the non-dom tax status, use the money to fund 2 million more hospital appointments every year. But Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister is oddly reluctant to follow us on this. What exactly is so special about this tax avoidance scheme that the Prime Minister prioritises it above the NHS? Yeah.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let's look at that record. We've, in the NHS, record funding, record doctors and nurses, record number of appointments, higher cancer survival rates. But what's happening under Labour's watch in Wales, Mr. Speaker? Let's have a look. A fifth of people in Wales are currently on a waiting list. Waits of 18 months or more are 10 times higher than that in England, and people are waiting twice as long for an operation. Their failure has sent the Welsh NHS back to square one, and we'll never let them do that here.
Blimey, it's quite a lot to unravel through there. Is that now more interventions from Lindsay Hoyle
than questions from the leader of the opposition?
I think it probably is. A notoriously publicity shy. Is it a mistake for Keir Starmer to keep talking about the government's recovery plan, highlighting that there is a plan?
Well, as long as it's not working,
yeah, I suppose so.
Then it's a quite effective attack, isn't it? You know, because you know, in the same way that Gordon Brown could talk relentlessly about you know, saving the economy or saving the world or saving the banks, as he put it in the space of a single sentence. And you won't be rewarded for it because people didn't feel that the economy had recovered in
the
same way that the NHS
is. That's the mantra that Labour are kind of adopting now at the moment, is that it's this kind of, do you feel better off now than you did 5 years ago? Or, you know, it's the Reagan mantra from 82. And I think they're going to keep returning to that. They want people to kind of look at it and think, we've had all these years of Conservative government and actually you haven't got a functioning NHS, you can't get a dentist, you can't get a GP appointment, you're paying more for your mortgages. You know, everything that the Tories have said that they're going to do, they haven't delivered on. And just the very language of using a recovery plan suggests that there's something has collapsed, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that is quite an effective argument for them. But it's being slightly lost here because of the kind of knockabout. And I think, you know, Rishi bringing Wales into play is quite an interesting thing to do because, you know,
those figures are bad.
They are bad. But again, if you compare that to what's going on in the NHS in England and the fact that he's just broken his own promise on it, it doesn't mean that he comes out of it kind of smelling of roses either.
No, it's interesting that. And I suppose the attack from Keir Starmer that he's tried to mount in previous weeks is to combine the out-of-touch thing, the wealth thing, which people already talked about, with a sort of out of touch with reality. The sort of, he's laughing and everything, you know, he's saying everything's okay. They haven't quite managed, it feels like they haven't quite got to the phrase yet to combine those. He's rich and out of touch, but he also, he's delusional about the state of the NHS or the state of schools, and they haven't quite found the phrase that ties that together. It feels, Patrick.
No, as you say, it needs that sort of, it's sort of, Blair used to say, you know, the moment he knew the leaders of the opposition opposite him were doomed was when he could come up with a pithy phrase that summed up the weakness of their approach. For instance, about our Times colleague William Hague, he said, sort of, good at jokes, but useless at everything else. And, it, you know, you don't feel Labour have quite nailed their attack on the Prime Minister. Not that it's, that's a, you know, election losing issue at all, but, you know, in terms of narrative, in a week where Labour have struggled to nail their narrative on their own policies, it's something that they could definitely improve on.
Howie's been in touch, says, I'm so confused what square one actually is. Where is it? What is it? When did it begin?
The problem is people would quite like to go back to square one if square one is, you know, before the past 13 years and their diagnosis is, well, it's time for a change.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As Caroline says, they don't feel better off than they did 13 years ago.
If you know, there's a certain type of person who's going to vote Labour, who would think, not having the pandemic, not having Brexit, not having austerity. I mean, there's, you know, obviously that parallel universe doesn't exist. But it's probably not the terrible situation that that maybe Rishi Sunak is trying to paint. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons now. We have got question number five from Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer.
Mr Speaker, when he admitted that he'd failed on waiting lists, I actually thought that we might be entering a new era of integrity, professionalism and accountability. Remember that one? But just like all the other relaunches, it's proved to be a false dawn, still blaming everyone else, still removed from reality. It's very simple. You can either back more NHS appointments or more tax avoidance. We know what side we're on. Why doesn't he?
Mr. Speaker, the best way to ensure that we continue to fund the NHS, as we have, is not to make £28 billion of unfunded spending commitments. But just this morning, independent Treasury officials have published a formal costing of just one part of their eco promise, their insulation scheme, and it turns out that it will cost double what they had previously claimed. Not the £6 billion that Labour accounted for, but £13 billion every single year. It's now crystal clear they have absolutely no plan, but we all know how they're going to fund that gap. More taxes on hard-working people.
So there we are. That's the document that I spotted just before PMQ started. So this is the ministers have asked the Treasury to cost the National Warm Homes Plan. And they say, this page shows the government's costing of opposition policies. Successive administrations have accepted that since departments provide factual answers to MPs and peers about the cost of identifiable changes in activities or benefits, there's no objection to officials providing ministers with similarly factual information about clearly identified opposition policies. Is this actually a row that the government want to have, the Tories want to have, Caroline, because then everyone will be talking about Labour's figures, and even if it's a row about whether or not they should be getting the Treasury to do it, it just makes a story about Labour's 28 billion again.
Yeah, because they want to persuade us all that, you know, Labour thinks it's got a magic money tree and that we're back to the kind of arguments that we had when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the opposition. So, you know, they are very focused on trying to kind of suggest that they've got uncosted, unfunded plans all the time. I mean, what's quite interesting about this is really where Keir Starmer comes about it and where his whole thrust of questioning has come from is that he's furious about the fact that the government keep promising things and then not delivering on it because he actually thinks that that is what's undermining trust in our politics. But actually, sadly, what's happened is because of what's happened with the 28 billion, that's now opened Labour up to the same accusations and criticisms. When actually, when you talk to people in the Labour Party, what they're actually saying is one of the reasons why they're kind of rowing back from this is because they don't want to make a commitment to something that they then can't deliver and fall into the same trap that the Tories have done. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it feels like we're in kind of Groundhog Day where we were with Brexit some time ago with, you know, the Treasury being dragged in to cost what Brexit was going to cost us and sending out leaflets to homes and sort of, you know, raising sort of spurious figures about all of this. And that may end up being the kind of sideshow that we get after this, actually.
Interesting point someone's just made on the YouTube channel watching along with us. The Rishi Sunak is trying to argue simultaneously, you have no plan, and your plan is going to cost billions more. So again, you, we were talking about Labour haven't really nailed their attack on the Tories. The Tories can't quite work out, is Keir Starmer a man with no plan, or is he a dangerous, overspending socialist who's going to ruin Britain?
Well, it's a cake and eat it thing, isn't it? It's very cakeist. Boris Johnson would very much admire this line of attack, and the 28 billion is an interesting case in point. And that question, by the way, and those Treasury figures are clearly designed to punch that bruise, just as the Labour Party wrings its hands and decides when exactly to announce that number is going, and that's being played out very publicly at the moment. You know, if Labour do drop the 28 billion, Rishi Sunak will say, you don't have a plan, you U-turn, you've got no principles. If, in the very unlikely event that it stays in any form, Rishi Sunak will say, you're a crypto Corbynite who's going to bankrupt the country. So Rishi Sunak is basically trying to have it always on his attacks on Keir Starmer. And the fact he's done both within the space of, you know, 15 minutes is a salutary reminder of that.
But to be fair to him, it's actually been quite effective, hasn't it? I mean, this is what's pushed Labour into this position, because actually there's no world where it ends up in a good scenario for them. Either they stick to it, can't deliver on it, or they ditch it and they get accused of basically doing a massive U-turn. So...
And actually, it is a reminder that, yes, Labour are 20 points ahead in the polls, but they're not, you know, they're not invincible. And the Tories have managed to get Labour into a pickle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of their own making. I'm fascinated by this document they've released. It includes the phrase, assumptions from special advisers. So they've basically, they've read an interview that Keir Starmer's done with The Mirror, and then they've come up with their own assumptions of what that means, and then they've come up with a big figure for what it costs. Incredible.
Sounds very scientific.
Yeah, so absolutely. Absolutely bang to rights. But let's go back to the House of Commons now. Does, as we always, we live in hope that it might happen. Can Keir Starmer tie it all up and put a bow on it? This is the last question from Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, this is Mr. 25 tax rises. He's literally the country's expert on putting taxes up. And he thinks he can lecture everyone else on the economy. Last week, he and his MPs were laughing at someone whose mortgage had gone up £1,000 a month. This week, he's casually made a £1,000 bet in the middle of an interview. Yeah. Last week, he thought even raising questions about the cost of living was, and I quote, resorting to the politics of envy. And this week, he's finally found the cause that he wants to rally around, the non-dom status. When he finds himself backing tax avoidance over NHS appointments, does he start to understand why his own MPs are saying he simply does not get what Britain needs?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to take any lectures about getting about getting Britain from a man who thought it was right to defend terrorists, Mr. Speaker. But what we're doing is building a brighter future for our country. And just the last week, expanding healthcare in pharmacies. Today, expanding dental care. This week, helping millions with the cost of living. And most importantly, cutting national insurance. All while the Labour Party argue over 28 billion different ways to raise people's taxes. That's the difference between us. We're delivering a plan. They can't even agree on one.
Well, it's quite a lot to detangle there. Let's start then, first of all, with he's Mr. 25 tax rises. Does that work? We had that before.
It sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't think I've heard the number 25 before, but it's interesting that he's put a number. You know, we've heard the tax attack before, haven't we? But I can't remember hearing that 25 number before. It's interesting though. That's the nub of everything he said there. Labour means tax increases.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was the other way around. He was saying that Rishi Sunak was 25 tax.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's how well that's landed. And then trying to tie together the £1,000 mortgage thing last week. Phil, poor old Phil in Iceland having his finances raked over. The £1,000 bet this week. But then he accused Rishi Sunak of rallying round the non-dom status. I think Rishi Sunak just ignored that completely, didn't he?
That's what I would have thought as well. I'm not sure, as you say, it all kind of tied together with a kind of beautiful bow at the end there. It's all rather confusing, actually.
And this line about defending terrorists, they're clearly just going to keep on pushing this
budget.
They're completely unrepentant. I mean, Oliver Dowden, just yesterday, was very stoutly defending that, saying, well, look, you know, it's sort of on a technicality, and
You know, I don't think you could look at Keir Starmer and say, I don't think, you know, it's plausible to say this guy's a terrorist sympathiser, but the Tories are just going to push it and push it and push it. It's the combination of that and tax rises, I think, that is going to be the overwhelming tone of the...
I'm just not sure the terrorist thing's going to kind of cut through, though. I mean, they must have focus grouped it and thought this is a really good idea. But, you know, if you go down the pub on a Saturday night and start talking to people about what they think about Keir Starmer, that's not the thing that immediately springs to mind.
This argument about these costings the Treasury have done of the Labour plan. Jill Rutter from the Institute for Government.
Late of Gordon Brown's Treasury, of course.
Yes, and did she work for John Major as well, I think?
She did, yeah.
So she's just tweeted saying, opposition costings first happened years ago when I was in the Treasury. The then Permanent Secretary should have said no then and should say no now. It'd be good if Rachel Reeves committed to not letting this happen. And then somewhere else, Jonathan Simmons, who I think, again, is a former civil servant. He's described the process of how this happens, where someone... Oh, I've lost it. Where has it gone? He basically said that... So he obviously, as a civil servant, would be asked to do opposition costings. OK, so let's assume this policy will work by uplifting teacher pay by 25%. OK, but that means, no, run me the numbers. OK, it's going to come out very expensive, but I don't think it's realistic because, cheers, got it, smash cut to this week's PMQs. That was basically it. Any attempt to say, yeah, but that's not going to really happen. Jill says, part of the deal when the Treasury agreed to do it was that SPADs would make the assumption, so that's why it says. So it's mad. So Conservative political appointees interpret the Labour Party policy and then ask the Treasury to run the numbers on it, and then they release the numbers and say, oh, it's expensive.
It does look a bit kind of back of the fag packet, doesn't it? Putting it mildly.
Yeah, and presumably as well, because this is to do with insulating homes to make them, to bring them up to a better level. With any other policy, you'd have a pot of money and you'd do as many homes as you could before the money ran out, yeah, rather than doing all of the homes regardless of the cost.
I think that is Labour's policy, though.
What? Do all the homes regardless of the cost?
Well, not regardless of the cost, but that's their ambition, to insulate every home.
Yeah, 19 million homes,
yeah,
over 10
years.
Yeah,
but don't forget, it would be subject to their fiscal rules. Keep forgetting that
everything
caveat.
Is.
To be fair to Ed Miliband, that is the case. Well, who do we think won that?
I think it was a score draw. I think, by the way, though, I mean, not that, you know, regular disclaimer applies that what's going on Westminster Twitter is not necessarily a guide to what the public will notice, but every MP and every lobby journalist I can see is having a go at the Prime Minister over his comments on transgender people.
Yeah.
Interesting that the Henry Zethman, later of this parish, now the BBC, says, as far as I could tell, Esther Jai was not in the public gallery for Rishi Sunak's comment about Keir Starmer's position on trans people at PMQ. She arrived about 15 minutes in and was there just now when a Labour MP called on Sunak to apologise to her. So what Keir Starmer said wasn't quite accurate, but it's, I think the Prime Minister will come under huge pressure to apologise. And it'll be interesting to see whether he does or not, because CCHQ clearly do think this is a wedge issue with which they can attack the Labour Party.
And that probably will end up being a bigger story than these made-up numbers they've released. Lara Spear will round up the best of the rest, and if it has come up again in some of those later questions, we'll do that next here on Times Radio.
Politics without the boring bits. Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Whoa! Vauxhall are having a special event from the 14th to the 29th of February, with an extra £500 saving on petrol cars.
Really? What about electric?
Wow! An extra £2,000 allowance on electric cars with 4.9% APR representative.
Including new Corsa?
Yes.
Astra?
Yes.
Mokka?
Yes!
Hey, where are you going?
Vauxhall retailer. See ya!
Personal contract purchase, electric vehicles only. T&C subject to status and availability, 18 plus, Stellantis Financial Services. At end of agreement, there are three options. Part exchange, pay optional final payment to own vehicle or return vehicle.
At McDonald's, we always listen to our fans. So, to the 716 people who've recently told us how much they miss the iconic breakfast wrap, we want you to know we heard you loud and clear. That's why we're finally bringing it back. Grab yours from the 7th of February. Served until 11 a.m, subject to availability.
Listen to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover's unique perspective on the day's stories every Monday to Thursday afternoon from 3.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Very good afternoon. It's Matt Chorley bringing you PMQs Unpacked. Caroline Wheeler, please go to the Sunday Times, is here, as is Times columnist and Sunday... No, Times columnist.
If only
Times
I was allowed to straddle both titles.
Times Radio senior political correspondent is Patrick McGuire is here, and Lama Spear, Red Box editor, is here as well. Now, as we were just discussing, one of the sort of standout moments, that's the right way of describing it, was Rishi Sunak's comments on Keir Starmer's policy or changing policy on the definition of a woman. And what was the phrase that he used?
It was 99.9% of women don't have a penis.
Which is what Keir Starmer said to you,
yes,
Caroline,
exactly.
In an interview.
Yeah.
Since then, the Labour's changed its policy again, it seems. And so he said he's made 99.9% of a U-turn. I think that was the context of all of this. Keir Starmer got very cross about it because he thought Brianna Jarre's mother, Esther, was in the gallery, which is what he'd already told the House. It seems that she wasn't. But this has now been raised by a Labour MP, Liz Twist, in the Commons. Let's listen to that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And may I take the opportunity to ask the Prime Minister if he will consider apologising to Brianna Gray's mother for his insensitive comment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But turning to my question, the independent report into Teesworks, released last Monday, throws up more questions than it answers.
Yeah.
And it's vital that we now have a National Audit Office investigation. The report was scathing and said there is insufficient transparency to offer evidence of value for money. Shouldn't the government lead by example? And will the Prime Minister finally release details of his conversations surrounding Teesworks, as he was asked to do twice last year?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Lady was talking about the report in Teesworks, as far as I can see. And what that report noted was that the pace and scope of the regeneration had a wide-reaching positive impact on the local economy. And, of course, it was an independent external report. It makes it clear that there's no evidence of corruption or illegality. And the government will, of course, respond to the recommendations in the report as soon as possible.
So lots of shouting there, calling for an apology. Patrick, you've been following the sort of social media reaction to this is pretty massive.
I mean, it is all anybody in Westminster is talking about. And it'll be the first thing so listeners may not be aware that immediately after PMQs, the entire press gallery, which is on a very rare occasion full for these things, decamps to the room behind the press gallery, behind the Commons Chamber. The Prime Minister's press secretary and official spokesman come up, and the first thing anybody will ask is the Prime Minister sorry? What's the Prime Minister going to say to Esther Jaye? What would the Prime Minister say to Esther Jaye? And everybody will be writing that story up this afternoon. So it's not just that, you know, Twitter is outraged, although lots of MPs have taken to social media to complain. It is very clearly what our colleagues in the press gallery will ask about. And the Rishi Sunak's sort of refusal to offer that apology.
Or to even acknowledge.
Indeed, completely. Yeah, yeah. Well, means that it'll just run.
No.
Well, I thought it was interesting. He put it down to a procedural. He sort of implied that there was a procedural reason why he couldn't answer that question. He beckoned to her, didn't he, and said that I thought the question was about Teesworks, as if he wasn't permitted to respond to that in any way, which, of course, I don't think is true.
Why he doesn't worry too much about answering the questions in other contexts.
At the very end of Prime Minister's questions, which is happening as we speak, Rishi Sunak apparently praised Esther Jaye, Brianna Jaye's mother, for showing the very best of humanity. Whether that's enough to put a lid on this.
Can we try and find that?
Is another question.
The other thing, Caroline, bluntly, being completely cynical, there's not a lot of political news around today.
No.
And this row dropping, you know, PMQs rarely produces a standalone story of its own. The fact that the whole country has been following this terrible story, the murder of Brianna Jaye, the fact that mother was in the gallery, albeit missing the actual exchange there. She was, it looks like from the footage, sitting above Rishi Sunak because Keir Starmer was sort of pointing at her while he was not answering those questions. This could become quite a big bomb for Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, partly because, as you so rightly said, there's not much to compete with this particular story, and it has been one of the biggest stories that we've seen over the last week breaking across all our sites. So, yeah, it could be a problem. I mean, I think he will stand by the fact that it was probably a scripted answer.
Mm.
And, you know, he has to respond very quickly, as I'm sure you can imagine. He's asked questions on a huge variety of subjects. You know, you can probably see if you watch it on television, he has that clip folder in front of him where he kind of reads out almost scripted answers about what he expects to come up. So it will have come kind of out of the blue to him, but you would have thought he could be a bit more agile in that situation.
Well, it's interesting. That's twice in a week Rishi Sunak's defence would be, oh, I was put in the spot, I was put under pressure, and I didn't know what to do, essentially. Yeah.
What was it last week?
Well, no, Piers Morgan, that was his response to the Piers Morgan thing, I was ambushed in an interview.
Easily ambushed.
Well, and that is not sort of a convincing defence of the Prime Minister. Also, you've got to give credit to Keir Starmer here, who is often criticised for not being fleet of foot and not being a particularly agile and imaginative Commons performer. That was entirely impromptu, his decision, and it was a snap political judgment, and it has elevated that exchange to the biggest story of the day. If Keir Starmer had not said that, we would not be talking about it now.
Okay, I think we've got the finally right at the end of PMQs. This is Rishi Sunak.
Because those, Mr Speaker, are the values of this Conservative government. And Mr Speaker, I could just say also to Breonna Gray's mum, who is here, as I've said earlier this week, what happened was an unspeakable and shocking tragedy, Mr Speaker. And as I said earlier this week, in the face of that, for her mother to demonstrate the compassion and empathy that she did last weekend, I thought demonstrated the very best of humanity in the face of seeing the very worst of humanity, and she deserves all our admiration and praise for that.
So, just to fill in the background of that, he was actually asked by Vicky Foxcroft, Labour MP, about why there's not a disabilities minister, and he pivoted into that. So, clearly, he knows he's got this one wrong, Carla.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think that those two things are kind of naturally interlinked, are they? So clearly he's realised he's made a boo-boo. I mean, perhaps he can hear some of the noise behind him. He may have been tapped on the shoulder, potentially by one of his aides or one of the whips, saying, I think you should possibly look at this. But he's clearly got, from the kind of reaction that he's had, that he needed to kind of say something on the record that was in some way, you know, showing some compassion towards what's happened to her family.
I don't know, slightly mishit. Did he also say Breonna Gray? I think he's got a name wrong as well, which isn't in the mopping up apology.
In fairness, both of them got the name wrong. So, you know, it's not been a great day for pronunciation, but it's probably worse.
Well, we'll see how that unfolds. Lara, in terms of other backbench questions, what else was of particular interest?
So I picked this one for Patrick because it is mentioning a fabled Labour hero, and it is from Alan Cairns, Conservative MP for a Welsh constituency, talking about the attack line that you hear a lot about Labour-run NHS in Wales, and saying something which I think some Labour figures are going to be very unhappy about, one particular Labour historical Labour figure about. So have a listen. Ooh.
Speaker, for 27 years, constituents across the Vale of Glamorgan and across the whole of Wales sadly have to wait longer to see a doctor, longer for an ambulance, longer at A&E, and longer for an operation than patients in England. There are 24,785 patients in Wales waiting longer than 2 years for an operation. That number in England is 227. Does my right honourable friend agree that Aneurin Bevan will be turning in his grave on the fact that you can't trust Labour with the NHS?
Well, Mr Speaker, my right honourable friend is absolutely right. Whereas here in England we have a plan when it comes to education, where we're marching up the league tables and we have virtually eliminated those waiting the longest amount of time. But in Labour-run Wales, as he said, education rates are falling and waiting lists over 18 months are more than 10 times higher than here in England. It's crystal clear we should stick to our plan for a brighter future and not go back to square one with Labour.
Oof. Nick Thomas-Simmons, the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister and biographer of Niall Bevan, will be absolutely furious to hear his name taken in vain. Again, that's another line we're likely to hear from the Tories at a general election, though. You know, you can't trust Labour with the NHS. Look at what's happening in Wales. Again, doesn't seem to be working or cutting through, particularly given the many problems with the NHS in England under Conservative management that Keir Starmer mentioned earlier. But it's a glimpse of how Tories, especially Welsh Tories, will seek to point to Labour in devolvum and undermine their programme for central government.
What else caught your eye, Lara?
Still
you're
recovering
worse
from
Prime
last
Minister.
Night. We're going to Tim Loughton, who is talking about this. This is a big issue at the moment, especially among Conservative MPs, this question about your religious conversion to Christianity being used in asylum claims and how relevant that is. And take a listen to Loughton asking about it.
Mr. Speaker, the thoughts of the people of East Worthing and Shoreham are with His Majesty as well. The Archbishop of Canterbury has admitted that since taking office, the attendance at the Church of England has dropped by 15%. And in the 10 years to COVID, the number of baptisms in the Church of England has fallen from 140,000 a year to 87,000. So Christianity in the UK seems to be on the wane, unless apparently you are from a Muslim country in the middle of an asylum claim. And we are now told that one in seven occupants of the Bibi Stockholm have suddenly become practicing Christians. Can I ask the Prime Minister, given that the Church of England has now issued secret guidance for clergy supporting asylum applications for these Damascene conversions, who is the Church accountable to, and are taxpayers being scammed by the Archbishop?
Mr. Speaker, when it comes to illegal migrants, we need to have a system whereby if someone comes here illegally, they shouldn't be able to stay. I can tell him that my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, has asked for more information about the extent to which migrants converting to Christianity is playing a role in our asylum system. And more generally, under our Illegal Migration Act, anyone entering the UK illegally will not be granted asylum here. That's why we need to have somewhere to send them and why our Rwanda scheme is so important. The Labour Party have blocked these measures every single step of the way because they don't have a plan and they won't keep Britain safe.
It's pretty strong stuff, Laura. The Archbishop is scamming the taxpayer.
Yeah, I think it's certainly somewhat of an escalation on the rhetoric that we've seen of this in recent days, and rhetoric that Rishi Sunak, I think, notably slightly resiled from repeating, trying to pivot and focus the attack on Labour instead. But I think it does speak to, you know, Tory MPs I've spoken to in the wake of reading more about this this issue of religious conversion in asylum cases. Some of them are very, very angry about it and feel like it is being used opportunistically, and that the government should be doing more to stop it. So,
and obviously, Colin, this is in the news because of the reported immigration status of the suspect in the alkaline attack that happened in South London. I think it was John Hayes on a couple of days ago on the show, and he was telling me how terrible it was, and the asylum system was being hijacked by the liberal establishment and the judiciary and the media and various other things. And I sort of pointed out, well, actually, the asylum system has been in the hands of the Conservative government for the last 14 years, and that they, as we've seen, they can apparently rewrite the rules as many times as they want to. Do you think it works, them attacking the church, or do you think the public will end up thinking, it's your asylum system?
Well, I think that's exactly what they're trying to do. It's a real kind of distraction technique, isn't it, to kind of put the blame somewhere else for this. And you're absolutely right. You know, they are in charge of the asylum system. And, you know, it speaks to a theme that we've seen a number of times during even this Prime Minister's question time, that it's all somebody else's fault and trying to effectively turn this into a, you know, Punch and Judy match, basically. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's all everybody else's fault. It's nothing on us. And trying to use this as... I mean, it just very clearly shows to me that we're heading towards an election quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not real politics, as it were.
And yet, quite slowly.
Very slowly.
Yes. Have you got any more? Any more for us, Lara?
Do we have time for another? Yes.
I think so. We can fit one more in.
So this is from the Conservative MP, Elliot Colburn, and it is about his personal struggle with mental health. And I think it's interesting for Rishi Sunak's response on this as well. So take a listen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. February marks Emotional Health, Boost Your Self-Esteem and Children's Mental Health Month. In recent years, something like 6,500 people die in the UK each year due to suicide. And in 2021, I was nearly one of them. Luckily, my attempt failed. I was found by family members quickly. I received amazing care at St Helier and Springfield hospitals, didn't do any permanent damage, and was well looked after by the NHS in the months that followed. And I want to take this chance to say thank you to everyone who saved me, and sorry to my family and loved ones who I put through such an awful ordeal. In that moment, I felt alone and scared and like there was no way out, and that the world would be better off without me in it. But I don't recognise that man anymore. I know that nothing is ever really worth that. Help really is out there, and I'm pretty awesome. Does the Prime Minister agree that one death by suicide is one too many? And will he send a message from the dispatch box today that whatever you're going through, you are not alone, that help is out there, and better days lie ahead?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I know the whole House will join me in commending my honourable friend for his bravery in sharing his story. And I can absolutely assure him that we take this issue incredibly seriously. The new suicide prevention strategy ensures that we will have the actions in place to reduce suicide over the next years, because we absolutely recognise the impact that it has on people, their families, and we should do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
Well, it was a nice, thoughtful question. I mean, pretty extraordinary. I don't think Elliot Coben's spoken about that before. He was elected as Conservative MP in Carl Shelton and Wallace in 2019, and he was saying that was in 2021, so it was while he was an MP.
Yeah, it's a very striking omission for an MP, particularly a Conservative MP, to make. You know, imagine 25 years ago an MP getting up in the Commons chamber and admitting so openly that they had made an attempt on their own life. It's...
Well, they couldn't have done it, actually. I mean, I remember the fact that we had to actually change the law because actually mental illness used to be an impediment to standing as an MP. And they changed that not that long ago. So actually, it just would not have happened.
Yeah. Well, it's good that he was making the point that it is emotional health, boost your self-esteem in Children's Mental Health Month. So that all those things are happening in February. So that's why he wanted to speak out. And Rishi Sunak responding with a similar tone, probably a better tone than he has in other parts of PMQs today. Well, that's all we've got time for, I think. But Lava, thank you for that. Lava Spoon, Patrick McGuire, Caroline Wheeler. No doubt the row over Rishi Sunak mocking Keir Starmer's stance on transgender will rumble on for the rest of the day. He's been accused of, because... The mother of murdered transgender teenager Brianna Jai was in Parliament today, arrived during the course of PMQs. Lots of MPs crying out shame at Rishi Sunak for mocking Keir Starmer's changing position on transgender rights. And then later on, Rishi Sunak paying tribute to Brianna Jai's family, presumably in a hope of removing some of the sting from that criticism. Right, that's quite enough for this week on PMQ's Unpacked. They won't be here next week because MPs are off for a mini break, as am I. Patrick McGuire will be looking after you. Next week, PMQ's Unpacked returns in a fortnight. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.